Chapter 3. Captain Raj Lyubov had a headache. It began softly in the muscles of his right shoulder and mounted crescendo to a smashing drumbeat over his right ear. The speech centers are in the left cerebral cortex, he thought, but he couldn't have said it. Couldn't speak, or read, or sleep, or think. Cortex, vortex, migraine headache, margarine breadache, ow, ow, ow. Of course, he had been cured of migraine once at college, and again during his obligatory army prophylactic psychotherapy sessions. But he had brought along some ergotamine pills when he left Earth, just in case. He had taken two, and a super-hyper-duper analgesic, and a tranquilizer, and a digestive pill to counteract the caffeine, which counteracted the ergotamine, but the all still bored out from within, just over his right ear, to the beat of the big bass drum. All, drill, ill, pill, oh God, Lord, deliver us, liver, sausage, what would the Athshians do for a migraine? They wouldn't have one. They would have daydreamed the tensions away a week before they got them. Try it. Try daydreaming. Begin as Selver taught you. Although knowing nothing of electricity, he could not really grasp the principle of the EEG. As soon as he heard about alpha waves and when they appear, he had said, "Oh yes, you mean this." And there appeared the unmistakable alpha squiggles on the graph, recording what went on inside his small green head. And he had taught Lyubov how to turn on and off the alpha rhythms in one half-hour lesson. There really was nothing to it. But not now. The world is too much with us. Ow, ow, ow. Above the right ear, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. For the Athshians had burned Smith Camp day before yesterday and killed 200 men. 207, to be precise. Every man alive except the captain. No wonder pills couldn't get at the center of his migraine, for it was on an island 200 miles away 2 days ago. Over the hills and far away, ashes, ashes all fall down. And amongst the ashes, all his knowledge of the high-intelligence life forms of World 41. Dust, rubbish, a mess of false data and fake hypotheses. Nearly 5 E-years here, and he believed the Athshians to be incapable of killing men, his kind or their kind. He had written long papers to explain how and why they couldn't kill men. All wrong, dead wrong. What had he failed to see? It was nearly time to be going over to the meeting at HQ. Cautiously, Lyubov stood up, moving all in one piece so that the right side of his head would not fall off. He approached his desk with the gait of a man underwater, poured out a shot of general issue vodka, and drank it. It turned him inside out. It extroverted him. It normalized him. He felt better. He went out and, unable to stand the jouncing of his motorbike, started to walk down the long, dusty main street of Centralville to HQ. Passing the luau, he thought with greed of another vodka. But Captain Davidson was just going in the door, and Lyubov went on. The people from the Shackleton were already in the conference room. Commander Young, whom he had met before, had brought some new faces down from orbit this time. They were not in Navy uniform. After a moment, Lyubov recognized them, with a slight shock, as non-Terran humans. He sought an introduction at once. One, Mr. Orr, was a hairy Setian, dark gray, stocky, and dour. And the other, Mr. Lepenin, was tall, white, and comely. A Hainish man. They greeted Lyubov with interest, and Lepenin said,
I've just been reading your report on the conscious control of paradoxical sleep among the Athshians, Dr. Lyubov.
Which was pleasant, and it was pleasant also to be called by his own earned title of doctor. Their conversation indicated that they had spent some years on Earth, and that they might be Hilfers, or something like it, but the commander, introducing them, had not mentioned their status or position. The room was filling up. Gassa, the colony ecologist, came in. So did all the high brass. So did Captain Sassoon, head of planet development, logging operations, whose captaincy, like Lyubov's, was an invention necessary to the peace of the military mind. Captain Davidson came in alone, straight-backed and handsome, his lean, rugged face calm and rather stern. Guards stood at all the doors. The army necks were all stiff as crowbars. The conference was plainly an investigation. Whose fault? My fault, Lyubov thought despairingly. But out of his despair, he looked across the table at Captain Don Davidson with detestation and contempt. Commander Young had a very quiet voice. As you know, gentlemen, my ship stopped here at World 41 to drop you off a new load of colonists, and nothing more. Shackleton's mission is to World 88, Prestno, one of the Hainish group. However, this attack on your outpost camp, since it chanced to occur during our week here, can't be simply ignored, particularly in the light of certain developments which you would have been informed of a little later in the normal course of events. The fact is that the status of World 41 as an Earth colony is now subject to revision, and the massacre at your camp may precipitate the administration's decisions on it. Certainly, the decisions we can make must be made quickly, for I can't keep my ship here long. Now, first, we wish to make sure that the relevant facts are all in the possession of those present. Captain Davidson's report on the events at Smith Camp was taped and heard by all of us on ship. By all of you here, also? Good. Now, if there are questions any of you wish to ask Captain Davidson, go ahead. I have one myself. You returned to the site of the camp the following day, Captain Davidson, in a large hopper with 8 soldiers. Had you the permission of the senior officer here at Central for that flight? Davidson stood up.
I did, sir.
Were you authorized to land and to set fires in the forest near the campsite?
No, sir.
You did, however, set fires.
I did, sir. I was trying to smoke out the creatures that killed my men.
Very well. Mr. Lepenin.
The tall Hainish man cleared his throat.
Captain Davidson, he said, do you think that the people under your command at Smith Camp were mostly content?
Yes, I do.
Davidson's manner was firm and forthright. He seemed indifferent to the fact that he was in trouble. Of course, these Navy officers and foreigners had no authority over him. It was to his own colonel that he must answer for losing 200 men and making unauthorized reprisals. But his colonel was right there, listening.
They were well-fed, well-housed, not overworked, then, as well as can be managed in a frontier camp.
Yes.
Was the discipline maintained very harsh?
No, it was not.
What, then, do you think motivated the revolt?
I don't understand.
If none of them were discontented, why did some of them massacre the rest and destroy the camp?
There was a worried silence. May I put in a word? Lyubov said. It was the native Hilfs
The Athshians, employed in the camp, who joined with an attack by the forest people against the Terran humans. In his report, Captain Davidson referred to the Athshians as Creechies. Lepenin looked embarrassed and anxious.
Thank you, Dr. Lyubov. I misunderstood entirely. Actually, I took the word Creechy to stand for a Terran caste that did rather menial work in the logging camps, believing, as we all did, that the Athshians were intraspecies non-aggressive. I never thought that they might be the group meant. In fact, I didn't realize that they cooperated with you in your camps. However, I am more at a loss than ever to understand what provoked the attack and mutiny.
I don't know, sir.
When he said the people under his command were content, did the captain include native people?
Said the Setian, or in a dry mumble. The Hainish man picked it up at once, and asked Davidson in his concerned, courteous voice,
Were the Athshians living at the camp content, do you think?
So far as I know.
There was nothing unusual in their position there, or the work they had to do?
Lyubov felt the heightening of tension, one turn of the screw, in Colonel Dunna and his staff, and also in the starship commander. Davidson remained calm and easy.
Nothing unusual.
Lyubov knew now that only his scientific studies had been sent up to the Shackleton. His protests, even his annual assessments of native adjustment to colonial presence, required by the administration, had been kept in some desk drawer deep in HQ. These two NTHs knew nothing about the exploitation of the Athshians. Commander Young did, of course. He had been down before today and had probably seen the Creechy pens. In any case, a Navy commander on colony runs wouldn't have much to learn about Terran-Hilf relations. Whether or not he approved of how the colonial administration ran its business, not much would come as a shock to him. But a Setian and a Hainish man, how much would they know about Terran colonies, unless chance brought them to one on the way to somewhere else? Lepenin and Orr had not intended to come on planet here at all. Or possibly they had not been intended to come on planet, but hearing of trouble, had insisted. Why had the commander brought them down? His will or theirs? Whoever they were, they had about them a hint of authority, a whiff of the dry, intoxicating odor of power. Lyubov's headache had gone. He felt alert and excited. His face was rather hot. Captain Davidson, he said, I have a couple of questions concerning your confrontation with the four natives day before yesterday. You're certain that one of them was San or Selva Thiele?
I believe so.
You're aware that he has a personal grudge against you?
I don't know.
You don't? Since his wife died in your quarters, immediately subsequent to sexual intercourse with you, he holds you responsible for her death. You didn't know that. He attacked you once before, here in Centralville. You had forgotten that? Well, the point is that Selva's personal hatred for Captain Davidson may serve as a partial explanation or motivation for his unprecedented assault. The Athshians aren't capable of personal violence. That's never been asserted in any of my studies of them. Adolescents who haven't mastered controlled dreaming or competitive singing do a lot of wrestling and fist-fighting, not all of it good-tempered. But Selva is an adult and an adept. And his first personal attack on Captain Davidson, which I happened to witness part of, was pretty certainly an attempt to kill, as was the captain's retaliation, incidentally. At the time, I thought the attack an isolated psychotic incident, resulting from grief and stress, not likely to be repeated. I was wrong. Captain, when the four Athshians jumped you from ambush, as you describe in your report, did you end up prone on the ground?
Yes.
In what position? Davidson's calm face tensed and stiffened, and Lyubov felt a pang of compunction. He wanted to corner Davidson in his lies, to force him into speaking truth once, but not to humiliate him before others. Accusations of rape and murder supported Davidson's image of himself as the totally virile man, but now that image was endangered. Lyubov had called up a picture of him, the soldier, the fighter, the cool, tough man, being knocked down by enemies the size of six-year-olds. What did it cost Davidson, then, to recall that moment when he had lain looking up at the little green men? For once, not down at them. I was on my back. Was your head thrown back or turned aside? I don't know. I'm trying to establish a fact here, Captain, one that might help explain why Selva didn't kill you, although he had a grudge against you and had helped kill 200 men a few hours earlier. I wondered if you might, by chance, have been in one of the positions which, when assumed by an Athshian, prevent his opponent from further physical aggression.
I don't know.
Lyubov glanced round the conference table. All the faces showed curiosity and some tension. These aggression-halting gestures and positions may have some innate basis, may rise from a surviving trigger response, but they are socially developed and expanded, and of course learned. The strongest and completest of them is a prone position, on the back. Eyes shut, head turned so that the throat is fully exposed. I think an Athshian of the local cultures might find it impossible to hurt an enemy who took that position. He would have to do something else to release his anger or aggressive drive. When they had all got you down, Captain, did Selva, by any chance, sing?
Did he what?
Sing. I don't know. Block. No go. Lyubov was about to shrug and give it up, when the Setian said,
"Why, Mr. Lyubov?"
The most winning characteristic of the rather harsh Setian temperament was curiosity. Inopportune and inexhaustible curiosity. Setians died eagerly, curious as to what came next. "You see," Lyubov said, "the Athshians use a kind of ritualized singing to replace physical combat. Again, it's a universal social phenomenon that might have a physiological foundation, though it's very hard to establish anything as innate in human beings. However, the higher primates here all go in for vocal competing between two males, a lot of howling and whistling. The dominant male may finally give the other a cuff, but usually they just spend an hour or so trying to outbellow each other. The Athshians themselves see the similarity to their singing matches, which are also only between males. But, as they observe, theirs are not only aggression releases, but an art form. The better artist wins. I wondered if Selva sang over Captain Davidson, and if so, whether he did because he could not kill, or because he preferred the bloodless victory. These questions have suddenly become rather urgent."
"Dr. Lyubov," said Lepenin, "how effective are these aggression-channeling devices? Are they universal?"
"Among adults, yes. So my informant state, and all my observations supported them, until day before yesterday. Rape, violent assault, and murder virtually don't exist among them. There are accidents, of course, and there are psychotics. Not many of the latter."
"What do they do with dangerous psychotics?"
"Isolate them, literally, on small islands."
The Athsians are carnivorous. They hunt animals.
Yes, meat is a staple.
Wonderful, Lepenin said,
and his white skin paled further with pure excitement.
A human society with an effective war barrier. What's the cost, Dr. Lyubov?
I'm not sure, Mr. Lepenin. Perhaps change. They're a static, stable, uniform society. They have no history. Perfectly integrated and wholly unprogressive. You might say that, like the forest they live in, they've attained a climax state. But I don't mean to imply that they're incapable of adaptation. Gentlemen, this is very interesting, but in a somewhat specialist frame of reference. And it may be somewhat out of the context which we're attempting to clarify here.
No, excuse me, Colonel Donna. This may be the point. Yes, Dr. Lyubov.
Well, I wonder if they're not proving their adaptability now. By adapting their behavior to us, to the Earth colony. For 4 years, they've behaved to us as they do to one another. Despite their physical differences, they recognized us as members of their species, as men. However, we have not responded as members of their species should respond. We have ignored the responses, the rights and obligations of nonviolence. We have killed, raped, dispersed and enslaved the native humans, destroyed their communities, and cut down their forests. It wouldn't be surprising if they'd decided that we are not human.
And therefore can be killed like animals.
Yes, yes,
said the Setian, enjoying logic. But Lepenin's face now was stiff as white stone.
Enslaved, he said.
Captain Lyubov is expressing his personal opinions and theories, said Colonel Dunna, which I should state I consider possibly to be erroneous. And he and I have discussed this type of thing previously, although the present context is unsuitable. We do not employ slaves, sir. Some of the natives serve a useful role in our community. The voluntary autochthonous labor corps is a part of all but the temporary camps here. We have a very limited personnel to accomplish our tasks here, and we need workers and use all we can get. But on any kind of basis that could be called a slavery basis, certainly not. Lepenin was about to speak, but deferred to the Setian, who said only,
How many of each race?
Garza replied,
2,641 Terrans now. Lyubov and I estimate the native Hilth population very roughly at 3 million.
You should have considered these statistics, gentlemen, before you altered the native traditions,
said Orr, with a disagreeable but perfectly genuine laugh.
We are adequately armed and equipped to resist any type of aggression these natives could offer, said the colonel. However, there was a general consensus by both the first exploratory missions and our own research staff of specialists here, headed by Captain Lyubov, given us to understand that the new Tahitians are a primitive, harmless, peace-loving species. Now, this information was obviously erroneous, or interrupted the colonel.
Obviously, you consider the human species to be primitive, harmless, and peace-loving, colonel? No. But you knew that the Hilfs of this planet are human as you or I or Lepenin, since we all came from the same original Hainish stock.
That is the scientific theory, I am aware.
Colonel, it is the historic fact.
I am not forced to accept it as a fact, the old colonel said, getting hot, and I don't like opinions stuffed into my own mouth. The fact is that these creatures are a meter tall, they're covered with green fur, they don't sleep, and they're not human beings, in my frame of reference.
Captain Davidson, said the Setian, do you consider the native Hylfs human or not?
I don't know.
But you had sexual intercourse with one, this Selver's wife. Would you have sexual intercourse with a female animal? What about the rest of you?
He looked about at the purple colonel, the flowering majors, the livid captains, the cringing specialists. Contempt came into his face.
You have not thought things through, he said.
By his standards, it was a brutal insult.
The commander of the Shackleton at last salvaged words from the gulf of embarrassed silence.
Well, gentlemen, the tragedy at Smith Camp clearly is involved with the entire colony-native relationship and is not by any means an insignificant or isolated episode. That's what we had to establish. And this being the case, we can make a certain contribution towards easing your problems here. The main purpose of our journey was not to drop off a couple of hundred girls here, though I know you've been waiting for them, but to get to Prestno, which has been having some difficulties, and give the government there an Ansible, that is, an ICD transmitter.
What?
Said Sereng, an engineer. Stares became fixed all around the table. The one we have aboard is an early model, and it cost a planetary annual revenue, roughly. That, of course, was 27 years ago, planetary time, when we left Earth. Nowadays, they're making them relatively cheaply. They're SI on Navy ships, and in the normal course of things, a robo or manned ship would be coming out here to give your colony one. As a matter of fact, it's a manned administration ship and is on the way, due here in 9.4 years, if I recall the figure.
How do you know that?
Somebody said, setting it up for Commander Young, who replied smiling. By the Ansible, the one we have aboard. Mr. Orr, your people invented the device. Perhaps you'd explain it to those here who are unfamiliar with the terms.
The Setian did not unbend.
I shall not attempt to explain the principles of Ansible operation to those present, he said. Its effect can be stated simply. The instantaneous transmission of a message over any distance. One element must be on a large mass body, the other can be anywhere in the cosmos. Since arrival in orbit, the Shackleton has been in daily communication with Terra, now 27 light-years distant. The message does not take 54 years for delivery and response, as it does on an electromagnetic device. It takes no time. There is no more time gap between worlds.
As soon as we came out of Nafal time dilatation into planetary space-time here, we rang up home, as you might say, the soft-voiced commander went on. And we were told what had happened during the 27 years we were traveling. The time gap for bodies remains, but the information lag does not. As you can see, this is as important to us as an interstellar species as speech itself was to us earlier in our evolution. It'll have the same effect to make a society possible.
Mr. Orr and I left Earth 27 years ago as legates for our respective governments, Tau Tu and Hain, said Lepenin.
His voice was still gentle and civil, but the warmth had gone out of it.
When we left, people were talking about the possibility of forming some kind of league among the civilized worlds. Now that communication was possible. The League of Worlds now exists. It has existed for 18 years. Mr. Orr and I are now emissaries of the Council of the League, and so have certain powers and responsibilities we did not have when we left Earth.
The three of them from the ship kept saying these things. An instantaneous communicator exists. An interstellar super-government exists. Believe it or not, they were in league and lying. This thought went through Lyubov's mind. He considered it, decided it was a reasonable but unwarranted suspicion. A defense mechanism, and discarded it. Some of the military staff, however, trained to compartmentalize their thinking, specialists in self-defense, would accept it as unhesitatingly as he discarded it. They must believe that anyone claiming a sudden new authority was a liar or conspirator. They were no more constrained than Lyubov, who had been trained to keep his mind open, whether he wanted to or not.
Are we to take all this simply on your word, sir?
Said Colonel Dunna, with dignity and some pathos. For he, too muddle-headed to compartmentalize neatly, knew that he shouldn't believe Le Penin or Orr or Young, but did believe them, and was frightened.
No, said the Setian, that's done with. A colony like this had to believe what passing ships and outdated radio messages told them. Now you don't. You can verify. We are going to give you the Ansible destined for Prestno. We have League authority to do so. Received, of course, by Ansible. Your colony here is in a bad way, worse than I thought from your reports. Your reports are very incomplete. Censorship or stupidity have been at work. Now, however, you'll have the Ansible and can talk with your Terran administration. You can ask for orders, so you'll know how to proceed. Given the profound changes that have been occurring in the organization of the Terran government since we left there, I should recommend that you do so at once. There is no longer any excuse for acting on outdated orders, for ignorance, for irresponsible autonomy.
Sour Asetian, and like milk he stayed sour. Mr. Orr was being overbearing, and Commander Young should shut him up. But could he? How did an emissary of the Council of the League of Worlds rank? Who's in charge here? Thought Lyubov. And he too felt a qualm of fear. His headache had returned as a sense of constriction, a sort of tight headband over the temples. He looked across the table at Le Penin's white, long-fingered hands, lying left over right, quiet on the bare, polished wood of the table. The white skin was a defect to Lyubov's earth-formed aesthetic taste, but the serenity and strength of those hands pleased him very much. To the Hainish, he thought, civilization came naturally. They had been at it so long. They lived the social intellectual life with the grace of a cat hunting in a garden, the certainty of a swallow following summer over the sea. They were experts. They never had to pose, to fake. They were what they were. Nobody seemed to fit the human skin so well, except perhaps the little green men. The deviant, dwarfed, over-adapted, stagnated creatures who were as absolutely, as honestly, as serenely what they were. An officer, Benton, was asking Le Penin if he and Orr were on this planet as observers for the, he hesitated, League of Worlds, or if they claimed any authority to... Le Penin took him up politely.
We are observers here, not empowered to command, only to report. you are still answerable only to your own government on Earth.
Colonel Dunna said with relief,
Then nothing has essentially changed.
You forget the Ansible,
Orr interrupted.
I'll instruct you in its operation, Colonel, as soon as this discussion is over. You can then consult with your colonial administration.
Since your problem here is rather urgent, and since Earth is now a League member, and may have changed the colonial code somewhat during recent years, Mr. Orr's advice is both proper and timely. We should be very grateful to Mr. Orr and Mr. LePennin for their decision to give this Terran colony the Ansible destined for Prestno. It was their decision. I can only applaud it. Now, one more decision remains to be made, and this one I have to make, using your judgment as my guide. If you feel the colony is in imminent peril of further or more massive attacks from the natives, I can keep my ship here for a week or two as a defense arsenal. I can also evacuate the women. No children yet, right?
No, sir, said Gossa. 482 women now.
Well, I have space for 380 passengers. We might crowd 100 more in. The extra mass would add a year or so to the trip home, but it could be done. Unfortunately, that's all I can do. We must proceed to Prestno, your nearest neighbor, as you know, 1.8 light years distant. We'll stop here on the way home to Terra, but that's going to be 3.5 more E-years at least. Can you stick it out?
Yes, said the Colonel, and others echoed him. We've had a warning now, and we won't be caught napping again.
Equally, said the Setian, can the native inhabitants stick it out for 3.5 Earth years more?
Yes, said the Colonel. No, said Lyubov. He had been watching Davidson's face, and a kind of panic had taken hold of him.
Colonel, said LePennin politely.
We've been here 4 years now, and the natives are flourishing. There's room enough and to spare for all of us. As you can see, the planet's heavily underpopulated, and the administration wouldn't have cleared it for colonization purposes if that hadn't been as it is. As for if this entered anyone's head, they won't catch us off guard again. We were erroneously briefed concerning the nature of these natives, but we're fully armed and able to defend ourselves. But we aren't planning any reprisals. That is expressly forbidden in the colonial code. Though I don't know what new rules this new government may have added on, but we'll just stick to our own as we have been doing, and they definitely forbid negative mass reprisals or genocide. We won't be sending any messages for help out. After all, a colony 27 light-years from home has come out expecting to be on its own, and to in fact be completely self-sufficient. And I don't see that the ICD really changes that, due to ship and men and material still have to travel at near light speed. We'll just keep on shipping the lumber home and look out for ourselves. The women are in no danger.
Mr. Lyubov, said LePennin.
We've been here 4 years. I don't know if the native human culture will survive 4 more. As for the total land ecology, I think Gossa will back me if I say that we've irrecoverably wrecked the native life systems on one large island, have done great damage on this subcontinent Sornal, and if we go on logging at the present rate, may reduce the major habitable lands to desert within 10 years. This isn't the fault of the colony's HQ or Forestry Bureau. They've simply been following a development plan drawn up on Earth without sufficient knowledge of the planet to be exploited. Its life systems, or its native human inhabitants.
Mr. Gossa," said the polite voice.
"Well, Raj, you're stretching things a bit. There's no denying that Dump Island, which was overlogged in direct contravention to my recommendations, is a dead loss. If more than a certain percentage of the forest is cut over a certain area, then the fiber weed doesn't recede, you see, gentlemen, and the fiber weed root system is the main soil binder on clear land. Without it, the soil goes dusty and drifts off very fast under wind erosion and the heavy rainfall. But I can't agree that our basic directives are at fault, so long as they're scrupulously followed. They were based on careful study of the planet. We've succeeded here on Central by following the plan. Erosion is minimal, and the cleared soil is highly arable. To log off a forest doesn't, after all, mean to make a desert, except perhaps from the point of view of a squirrel. We can't forecast precisely how the native forest life systems will adapt to a new woodland, prairie, plowland ambience foreseen in the development plan. But we know the chances are good for a large percentage of adaptation and survival.
That's what the Bureau of Land Management said about Alaska during the first famine, said Lyubov. His throat had tightened so that his voice came out high and husky. He had counted on Gossa for support. How many Sitka spruce have you seen in your lifetime, Gossa? Or snowy owl? Or wolf? Or Eskimo? The survival percentage of native Alaskan species and habitat after 15 years of the development program was 0.3%. It's now zero. Forest ecology is a delicate one. If the forest perishes, its fauna may go with it. The Athshean word for world is also the word for forest. I submit, Commander Young, that though the colony may not be in imminent danger, the planet is...
Captain Lyubov, said the old colonel. Such submissions are not properly submitted by staff specialist officers to officers of other branches of the service, but should rest on the judgment of the senior officers of the colony, and I cannot tolerate any further such attempts as this to give advice without previous clearance. Caught off guard by his own outburst, Lyubov apologized and tried to look calm. If only he didn't lose his temper, if his voice didn't go weak and husky, if he had poise. The colonel went on.
It appears to us that you made some serious, erroneous judgments concerning the peacefulness and non-aggressiveness of the natives here, and because we counted on this specialist description of them as non-aggressive is why we left ourselves open to this terrible tragedy at Smith Camp, Captain Lyubov. So I think we have to wait until some other specialists in Hilfs have had time to study them, because, evidently, your theories were basically erroneous, to some extent.
Lyubov sat and took it. Let the men from the ship see them all passing the blame around like a hot brick. All the better. The more dissension they showed, the likelier were these emissaries to have them checked and watched over. And he was to blame. He had been wrong. To hell with my self-respect, so long as the forest people get a chance, Lyubov thought. And so strong a sense of this own humiliation and self-sacrifice came over him that tears rose to his eyes. He was aware that Davidson was watching him. He sat up stiff, the blood hot in his face, his temples drumming. He would not be sneered at by that bastard Davidson. Couldn't Orr and Lepenin see what kind of man Davidson was? And how much power he had here? While Lyubov's powers, called advisory, were simply derisory. If the colonists were left to go on with no check on them but a super radio, the Smith Camp massacre would almost certainly become the excuse for systematic aggression against the natives. Bacteriological extermination, most likely. The Shackleton would come back in 3.5 to 4 years to New Tahiti and find a thriving Terran colony, and no more Creechy problem. None at all. Pity about the plague. We took all precautions required by the code, but it must have been some kind of mutation. They had no natural resistance, but we did manage to save a group of them by transporting them to the New Falkland Isles in the Southern Hemisphere, and they're doing fine there, all 62 of them. The conference did not last much longer. When it ended, he stood up and leaned across the table to Lepenin.
You must tell the League to do something to save the forests, the forest people, he said almost inaudibly, his throat constricted. You must. Please, you must.
The Hainish man met his eyes. His gaze was reserved, kindly, and deep as a well. He said nothing.